From Washington, this is Daybreak Asia. Good morning, I'm Jim Stevenson. Coming up, Pakistanis flee North Waziristan. Thai junta alters security plan to quell southern insurgency. Thailand, meanwhile, says it doesn't deserve to be on the human trafficking blacklist. These stories and more on this Monday edition of VOA's Daybreak Asia. Pakistan says more than 300,000 people, including women and children, have left its North Waziristan border district, where an army counter-terrorism offensive is underway. But a senior minister has rejected UN reports that thousands of Pakistanis have also fled into Afghanistan to seek safety. Ayaz Ghul reports from Islamabad.
The military undertook the offensive more than a week ago to flush out local and foreign fighters from the volatile Waziristan region. These extremists are said to be involved in insurgent attacks in Pakistan and across the Afghan border. Army officials say they have killed more than 260 militants in and around the war zone, mostly foreigners, they say, while several soldiers have died in retaliatory attacks. Independent confirmation of the accounts is difficult because the area is not accessible to journalists and aid workers. But the fighting has caused a flood of people to flee Waziristan. Federal Minister Abdul Qadir Baloch is supervising relief operations for the internally displaced people. He tells VOA that the number of refugees is swelling by the day and is expected to go well beyond 400,000. The minister says families are being provided with food, drinks and cash to meet their urgent needs, while long-term arrangements to support the displaced are also being worked out. However, Baloch says few families have shown up at the relief centers.
We have established camps for them at four different points. But tendency so far observed is that people coming out from North Waziristan, they don't like to stay in the camps. They prefer to go back, to go to different areas, to their relations, etc., and to take houses on rent and live elsewhere instead of living in the camps. This is because of their traditions and customs.
Pakistani officials say that shortly after the army offensive began, the local administration assisted 400 Afghan refugee families to return to Afghanistan from a border village in North Waziristan. Baloch acknowledged a few Pakistanis may also have crossed the border in search of safety, but he rejected UN reports that more than 6,000 Pakistanis have taken refuge in eastern Afghan areas.
So far, that figure is not known. A few probably. We were told that about 30 people, but we don't have reports. Of those, 1,000 is totally wrong. There's a misinformation.
He says that Pakistan has so far not asked the UN or other international groups to assist in tackling the refugee crisis.
We are not going to request anybody to come to our help. We are going to take care of our problem ourselves, and we are capable of doing so. But if some country or some organization, if they voluntarily want to contribute something to this great humanitarian problem which is being confronted by Pakistan, we will welcome that.
Baloch, a former army general, says that security forces have cordoned off entire areas in Waziristan where counter-terrorism operations are underway in order to prevent militants from fleeing. He added that Islamabad has arrangements with the Afghan government that they should make sure nobody crosses to that side of the border. Responding to reports that the army operation could go on for months in view of the difficult mountainous terrain, the Pakistani minister said, "Our desire is that it should meet its ends and it should be as short as possible." Ayaz Ghul for VOA News, Islamabad.
The UN Refugee Agency reports more than 6,000 refugees have fled into Afghanistan to escape fighting between Pakistan government forces and Taliban militants in the North Waziristan region. The agency says it's bracing for a larger exodus if fighting continues to escalate. Lisa Schlein reports from UNHCR headquarters in Geneva.
The UN Refugee Agency reports 6,452 Pakistanis have fled into the eastern parts of Afghanistan from North Waziristan. UNHCR spokesman Adrian Edwards says his agency is helping authorities in the eastern province of Khost to register and assist those arriving.
The newly arrived women, men and children have trekked across the mountains from Pakistan to seek safety. They're being accommodated with local Afghan communities for now, However, clearly these communities have limited resources and absorption capacity to help.
Edward says shelter, clean drinking water and sanitation are urgently needed. He says UNHCR is concerned that families close to where the fighting is raging will be exposed to further violence. And this, he says, could make it difficult for aid agencies to reach them with humanitarian aid. Pakistan's military mounted an offensive to oust al-Qaeda-linked Taliban insurgents from North Waziristan June 12th, a week after the militant group attacked Pakistan's biggest airport in Karachi. That dramatic attack left 36 people dead, including 10 Taliban gunmen. It also caused ceasefire talks with so-called moderate Taliban to collapse. This prompted Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif to launch an all-out assault on North Waziristan to remove the Taliban from their tribal base. But the fighting is causing a flood of people to flee their homes in search of safety. The Pakistani government confirms more than 100,000 people have been displaced internally from North Waziristan into several areas of Khyber Pakhtunkhwa province. UNHCR spokesman Edwards tells VOA, the Pakistani government has not yet asked for assistance, but if it does, his agency and others will do what they can to help. In the meantime, he says, his agency will work to assist the thousands of refugees who have fled into Afghanistan.
We're always concerned when people are displaced. The difficulties in this area, as you know, it's an insecure area. It's very difficult to access, mountainous. Getting help to people there is challenging, to say the least.
Pakistan has been hosting hundreds of thousands of Afghan refugees for years, but in a worrying turnabout, Edwards notes this is the first time refugees from Pakistan have fled into Afghanistan. He says there are no refugee camps in that part of Afghanistan. He adds the work ahead is daunting. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Later on Daybreak Asia, an atrocity in Myanmar is remembered as human rights activists push for official acknowledgement of the tragedy. Thailand's military junta is putting a new security measure in place in a bid to calm the country's rest of southern region, where fighting with Muslim separatists has claimed more than 5,000 lives in the past decade. As Ron Corbin reports from Bangkok for VOA, the military leaders are also hoping to restart peace talks with insurgents.
A new command structure for Thailand's southern border provinces will have junta leader General Prayut Chan-o-Nokha replace civilian authorities as the army takes a lead role in efforts to halt rising violence in the south. Civilian organizations will come under the military command. The junta, which is known as the National Council for Peace and Order, took power a month ago and says it hopes to restart stalled peace talks. Reports say the military is looking to the Malaysian government to act as a facilitator to restart the talks. Chulalongkorn University political scientist Panattan Mataniagorn was an advisor to past Thai governments on security issues in the southern provinces. He says the military has unified control to overcome policy shortcomings under past civilian governments.
That's my observation. You have a more unified structure. You also shorten the command control. That suggests that they may want to do something more in the south soon. To me, I think the success could depend on at a strategic level or at a policy level. I think with that unity at the top, we are hoping that a new initiative, particularly in terms of governance, in terms of politics, will come out, you know, and that will be very positive on the ground.
Panattan said the policy had been weakened under past civilian governments due to conflict between the civilian and military operations. The decade-long insurgency has claimed the lives of more than 5,800 people and wounded more than 10,000. The most frequent targets of insurgent attacks are ethnic Thai Buddhists and ethnic Malay Muslims in the provinces of Pattani, Narathiwat and Yala. Failed attempts to quell the insurgency have included crackdowns, efforts to win over local communities, and heavy spending by the central government to spur local development. Brutal attacks on teachers and state officials by insurgents have led to accusations of extrajudicial killings by authorities, perpetuating a cycle of violence. Panattan says the new structure may be more administratively efficient, but local residents may fear the diminished role of civilian authorities in policy making.
military heavy, you know, influence maybe raise some concerns on the ground, particularly in terms of a new round of negotiation, or maybe the a new negotiation on the master plan for the governance, or even on a day-to-day daily operations.
Rights advocates have also raised concerns over the military seeking to restart direct negotiations with the insurgents. Peace talks under the former civilian government of Prime Minister Yingluck Shinawatra collapsed last year, and there was no fresh date set for them to recommence. Rights advocate Ankana Nilapaichit is the wife of missing Muslim lawyer Somchai Nilapaichit. She says a neutral body is needed to lead talks rather than the military.
If the military, if they want to work on the peace process, how can they be entrusted by another groups or armed groups? Because I think we need the neutral people to talk to both sides, not to use violence, and go to the table and then discuss what happened.
Analysts expect the military will work quickly on new initiatives aimed at producing results, including legal moves to encourage insurgents to give up arms, while ruling out insurgent calls for greater regional autonomy. Ron Corbin for VOA News, Bangkok, Thailand.
Thailand is asking the United States to reconsider its placing of the kingdom in the bottom tier of the annual State Department report on human trafficking, which was released Friday. VOA correspondent Steve Herman has the story from Bangkok.
Thailand is expressing regret, disappointment, and disagreement with the decision by the U.S. State Department to rank it among the countries doing the least to combat trafficking in persons. American diplomats characterized the Thai government's approach as being full of promises but short on results. Thailand, Malaysia, the Gambia, and Venezuela were demoted to Tier 3, the lowest category, joining such states as Cuba, Iran, North Korea, and Zimbabwe. The permanent secretary of the Thai Ministry of Foreign Affairs, Sihasik Phuketkau, says Thailand does not deserve to be ranked in the bottom tier, which is for nations deemed not in compliance with the minimum standards for eliminating trafficking.
I do know that Thailand is doing better, much better than the other countries in that category. I'm sure you can vouch for that also. Does that reflect where Thailand stands? Does that provide the kind of support, encouragement for us to continue doing what we've been doing? So I ask the United States whether Thailand should be in that category.
The permanent secretary says the government, which was taken over by the military in a coup a month ago, will ask Washington to reconsider its assessment of Thailand and reevaluate the tangible progress made in the past year. Sihasik takes issue with the idea behind the U.S. State Department's annual trafficking in persons report, which ranks 188 countries into three tiers.
We don't believe that it is right for one country to use its own yardstick to evaluate what another country is doing, or the performance of another country in terms of dealing with this problem.
The State Department Friday contended the Thai government had demonstrated few efforts to address these trafficking crimes. Being placed on the Tier 3 blacklist can prompt sanctions and make multinational companies hesitant to invest in a country accused of not sufficiently fighting against trafficked labor. Thailand has faced considerable scrutiny, accused of being what some activists term a hub of human slavery. International media investigations over the past year have alleged barbaric conditions for workers sold to Thailand's shrimp fishing fleets. Pulitzer Prize-winning articles by the Reuters news agency accused Thailand's navy of being involved in trafficking Rohingya Muslims, escaping from persecution in neighboring Myanmar. Journalists and researchers in Thailand who expose such abuses, which also extend to the agriculture sector, for years have faced threats of violence, lawsuits, and criminal charges. Thailand's foreign ministry says, despite disappointment with the designation, the country stands ready to do more and will continue with concerted efforts to rid the country of human trafficking, calling it our national priority. Steve Herman, VOA News, Bangkok.
We look forward on Daybreak Asia to lunch with a Chinese billionaire, but there's a catch to the offer. Polling stations across Hong Kong opened Sunday in an unofficial referendum on democratic reform in the former British colony, a move that has angered Beijing. Nearly 600,000 votes have been cast in 3 days of online and telephone voting that began Friday. Chinese Communist Party authorities have declared the referendum illegal and without effect, as has the government of Hong Kong. The Occupy Central movement, which organized the balloting, opened actual voting stations Sunday after a massive cyber attack on their voting website last week. The voting period was also extended until June 29th. The referendum proposes three options for citizens to choose who can run for the chief executive office of Hong Kong. Currently, candidates are chosen by a pro-Beijing committee. 11 years ago in Myanmar, also known as Burma, 70 people associated with the National League for Democracy, the NLD, were killed in what has become known as the Dapayan Massacre. Human rights activists say the massacre was arranged by Myanmar's military government. Daybreak Asia's Dave DeForest spoke with George Washington University International Development Professor Christina Fink about the circumstances surrounding the killings.
In 2002 and 2003, Aung San Suu Kyi was traveling around the country trying to reconnect with ordinary citizens and also members of her political party because she had been under house arrest and unable to communicate with them previously. And the regime got increasingly concerned about the fact that so many people were turning out to see her. And so there started to be people appearing at her rallies that were attacking her verbally and also carrying sticks and threatening her and the NLD convoy. And during the attack itself, she had actually spoken a bit earlier and was driving back into a town in Upper Burma. And she was blocked on the road by two monks who came out in front of the car and said, stop. And then about 5,000 people poured out onto the road and started attacking her car and the other cars that were in her convoy and villagers who had come out from the village she had just left.
So were they trying to kill her? Was this an assassination attempt?
It seems that way, although she was not killed. But the NLD has said that they believe that at least 70 people who were NLD members and supporters were killed there. In many cases, they were beaten to death. Her car was actually able to get out of the melee and drive further down the road where the car was intercepted, and then she was sent to prison.
Who were these attackers? Were they paid by the government, recruited by the government?
Well, the government, until today, has not issued a report about what actually happened there. According to the government, these were people who did not like Aung San Suu Kyi and the NLD, and they acted of their own volition. But other credible organizations have suggested that, in fact, this was well organized because up to 5,000 people were brought in from other areas, and they were actually waiting in two strategic locations along the road that Aung San Suu Kyi was traveling on, and came out armed with sticks, knives, iron spears to attack her car and the other cars in the motorcade.
When talking about who the attackers are, usually the organization USDA comes up. Were they responsible or were their members responsible for this attack?
You know, again, they have not admitted responsibility, but it's widely believed that members of the Union Solidarity Development Association, which was a mass organization organized by the military regime as a support organization, that some of their members were involved. It does not mean that everybody in the USDA would have agreed with carrying out such an attack. It's also believed that there were members of a militia called Swan Shin who were involved, and perhaps that there were prisoners who had been released from prison, criminal prisoners who were brought in to carry out the attack.
What was the result immediately of this massacre? Did it, in fact, keep the democracy movement from spreading, or did it do the opposite of that?
The movement froze at that time. Aung San Suu Kyi herself was put in prison for a little over 3 months and then transferred back to house arrest. Other NLD members who were in the convoy and were caught were also put in prison. More than 150 NLD members and supporters were sent to prison, and many of them spent several months or longer in prison. So the movement basically stopped. But internationally, sanctions were increased, and in the United States, an import ban was imposed on goods coming from Burma.
With the increase in democracy in Burma, is it likely that this massacre will again become a political issue?
Well, Aung San Suu Kyi has said that she is willing to let bygones be bygones, but there are other people who were victims in the massacre, who were severely injured, who were imprisoned, who say that they want the truth to come out. They want the government to admit who organized the attack, who was involved, what was the purpose. They want the government to come clean about this.
Christina Fink is a professor of international development at the George Washington University in Washington, D.C. She spoke with Daybreak Asia's Dave DeForest. In an effort to attract more foreign tourists, North Korea is introducing a number of new tour packages, including camping trips in the scenic mountains of Myeonghyang and Kumgang. Koryo Tours, which organized the first 10-day camping trip last month, claims this is the first time anyone's been allowed to set up a tent and stay in the mountains. This was as much a treat for the guides as they had never done it before either, its website reads. The group of about 10 Westerners who took the trip hiked 79 kilometers during the entire tour, or about 28 kilometers per day. The travelers also got to visit some landmarks in both of the mountains, such as the Kumgang Waterfall and Lake Samilpo. For the cash-strapped north, more foreign tourists equal more foreign currency. Trips to the famed Mount Kumgang were first introduced by South Korea's Hyundai Asan, an arm of the conglomerate of Hyundai Group. Hyundai Asan shut down its Mount Kumgang tourist region in 2008, but Pyongyang was able to utilize what was left of it to resume the area's tourism business. Chinese billionaire Chen Guangbiao, who considers himself China's top philanthropist, is offering to buy lunch for 1,000 homeless people in New York City. Some say the offer is a noble gesture, while others consider it a gimmick from the Chinese tycoon who once made news by offering to buy the New York Times newspaper. Feng Bing of VOA's Mandarin service has this report, narrated by Colin Lovett.
Chen Guangbiao announced the event in prominent ads in the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal. He says he'll buy lunch for 1,000 homeless people at a fancy New York City restaurant and give each of them $300 after the meal. At a Manhattan restaurant, Matthew, who would only give his first name, says he thinks the offer is politically motivated.
I guess Chinese bureaucrats are entitled to engage in media stunts just like American politicians are.
But Anthony Shaw and his family have been homeless in New York for 3 months after moving there from Florida. For them, any help now is much appreciated.
He cares about the people.
Yeah, he cares about the people.
That's really good, though, because that helps a lot of people. Therefore, that also helps himself.
But Mr. Lee, who would not give his first name, has a different take on Chen's motivations.
He wants to use this chance to help and improve his reputation for his business, of course. His reputation will be spread, and people will choose and trust him. Then a large sum of money will return to his hands.
The free meal is scheduled to be held on June 25th at the swanky Low Boathouse in Central Park. For Fang Bing, I'm Colin Lovett, VOA News.
Well, if you can't enjoy lunch with a billionaire, you can write to us if you like. Our email address is daybreakasia@voanews.com. You can write to us just about anything. If you have story ideas, program comments, or just want to say hello, we'd love to hear from you. Also, stop by our website at voanews.com. And if you add /daybreakasia to it, you'll get our program page. We've got a lot of exciting stuff there, and we keep it fresh and up to date just for you. Stop by when you have a chance. We encourage you to stay tuned for the latest world news. It's next with Steve Norman and International Edition. I'm Jim Stevenson. Thanks for listening to Daybreak Asia.
Understand what's happening today. Take a look at what happened yesterday.
Flash, Washington. The White House announces Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor.
That's one.